Willkommen zur 185. Ausgabe
Welcome to the 185th edition of Europe Calling. I'd like to especially welcome today's guest, the German Federal Minister for Economic Affairs and Climate Action and Vice Chancellor, Mr. Robert Habeck. Dear Mr. Habeck, thank you for having taken the time to be here. And I'd like to welcome the over 7,000 participants from over 40 countries. It's a very international webinar. I'm Maximilian Fries. I'm the Executive Director of Europe Calling, and I'll be the moderator this evening. And before we start, some brief housekeeping remarks. We shall be speaking mostly German today. That's why we have entrusted two interpreters with a simultaneous interpretation into English. And I'll briefly also explain in English how this works.
In English, we will be speaking mostly German today, and I would like to thank our two interpreters in advance. You can select English in the control bar and the little globe and on mobile devices under More. Dann wieder ins Deutsche zurück. Im Zentrum
Switching back to German. Your questions to Robert Habeck are at the core of this meeting, as there are many of them. We have started collecting them since last night. There's over 400. That is going to be difficult in 60 minutes. Obviously, we won't be able to answer all of them, but you are actively liking and will try to pose those questions with most of the likes. Whoever was here a year ago will know how it works. Now, if you have any more pressing questions to Robert Habeck, please use the Q&A functionality on Zoom. And we're live on YouTube, and we'll make this stream available as a podcast afterwards. So if you do ask questions, please consider this. Without further ado, I'll give the floor to Robert Habeck for a brief input, after which we'll start with your questions. Thank you for allowing me to be here again at Europe Calling. Hello to all of you. I'll start with Europe, but then of course we can go through the different questions. But during the first 2-3 minutes, I'd like to speak about Europe. Now, over the last 2-3 years, Europe has proven itself as a political actor. Over the last years, Europe really grew into a union of states after the war of aggression against Ukraine. The European states, with a few exceptions like Hungary, supported Ukraine massively. This is still the case, also materially speaking. Colleagues came together to provide transformers and other energy devices. There was great big efforts of solidarity in order to ensure the energy supply for the first time. Gas and electricity was perceived as a matter of security, and that, of course, is also going to be decisive for the European Union in the future. I am, of course, mainly responsible for energy and climate, and huge progress has been achieved in these domains. Of course, also accelerated because of the war. But at the end of the day, we did have a climate program that we worked on with the Green Deal and all of its elements. The Green Deal has been concluded successfully. The effects can be felt in the natural laws and in the CO2 reduction and avoidance in the future. But to be honest, I wouldn't have thought that it would be possible at the beginning that we would be successful in concluding these legal proposals, but we were successful, and that in times of crises. If you now take a look at what Europe has to be willing to do, we should certainly not lean back. We've had 2 or 3 of successful years, and these should be used as an impulse for the future. Europe must become stronger, and Europe must also be more present as an actor on the world stage. It's a bit like it was ahead of the introduction of the euro, where it is required to have a European policy in different areas. This, of course, relates to fiscal policy, but it also means that there are other areas that we have to focus on. Armaments policy, for example, or foreign policy, and also on a military level, we need to become more robust. So to build up a common European defense industry, that's all still very national. I'm not sure whether we'll be able to speak about this afterwards. For this to be successful, Europe must reform itself and become more of a political actor. And we must find a common ground in quite a few areas. Those would be my introductory remarks, and I now look forward to any questions you may have. Thank you very much. Perhaps I'll take the floor. It was supposed to be a special question for the end, but because you spoke about the Ukraine and defense, I perhaps ask this question today. Today in the European Parliament, the European Council was demanded to send 7 Patriot systems to Ukraine. So this was quite a sign coming from the European Parliament. How do you see this? Well, it underlines what I said. There's a great solidarity when it comes to Ukraine at the EU level, and that is also important. When you take a look at the potential motives of Putin, now there are two nationalistic geopolicies. Well, to go back to the old times and to combat democracy and European cohesion. Also perhaps with the fear that this could infect Russia, and leading to people expressing their desire to be free. So it is extremely important that we, of course, support Ukraine, because they're fighting for their integrity, for their country, and for their freedom, but that this war is also in line with our interests. Now, often these discussions also about the defense aspects take place behind closed doors. But of course, it also needs to be ensured that countries themselves are able to defend themselves. I do not believe that the European states will simply decide to keep back material. But of course, that also depends on analysis. It depends on how much pressure is being exerted on Ukraine. If there is a lot of pressure, other steps might take place. That is something I do not know now. I can't announce it or contradict it. But I can tell you that all European governments, including the German one, are intensively discussing whether something can be given away to Ukraine without endangering one's own ability to defend oneself. So the appeal of the European Parliament has certainly been heard. Thank you. And we'll move on to our top questions. Sile Enencio and Willy Putz asked similar questions. Those were the top English questions. They are asking the following. Germany depends on Chinese lithium. They are flagship projects that are working in a resilient European supply chain. State funds are required for this. Will funding be provided? And if yes, when? And allow me to connect another question to this. Then you'll be able to reply to this. Monika Mangelt asks something similar. What are you doing to keep the German producers of solar panels in Germany, to keep them from going abroad? So the big question is, how do we keep green technologies of the future in Germany and in Europe? Well, the questions are closely tied, because of course they relate to economic security. And it needs to be clear that economic security, that security has a price. We are dependent when it comes to certain products, also when it comes to raw materials, because we no longer produce them in our own country. Why don't we do this? Because they are cheaper to produce abroad, and that is often China. If we were to insource these, or if we wanted to diversify, this is going to cost money. So, to call a spade, for economic security reasons, we're somewhat working against the powers of the market. Even though, especially when it comes to China, it has to be said that these products are extremely cheap because of the subsidies provided. So this is a distortion of the competition and certainly no level playing field. But of course, it is true. The dependence on raw materials is very high, sometimes over 90%, which of course isn't healthy. That is why we created a raw materials fund. France and Italy already have something like this. It's a state fund that allows to enter projects with capital to ensure that companies who consider certain markets or regions as too risky actually dare to do this. I nevertheless think that we need to have a European approach. You just alluded to China. Of course, Germany, France, and Italy are strong, but together we're stronger. But of course, this is also the case for Poland or the Netherlands or for other countries, and that is why at a minister level we're trying to identify common projects. But especially in Germany, the companies that know how to do this aren't all that numerous anymore. For the last 30 years, we reduced our mining activities, so money is available, but we actually have to find the companies. That also means that we have to close the raw material circles, aside from extraditing raw earth, we should ensure that those materials that are already available go back into closed loops. With other words, product recycling is definitely going to be a focus area in the strategy. With regards to solar panels, well, here, of course, the Chinese market is offering cheap products to the rest of the world. We have the so-called Net Zero Industrial Act, which is an answer to this. It doesn't only fund investment costs, that's already allowed today, and we're starting a new tender for this in order to be able to scale up a few companies in Germany, but we're also dealing with a resilience bonus here in order to bridge a piece of the price delta. That doesn't mean that we'll have 100% of the solar production in Germany or in Europe, but that isn't required. What is required is that we have the competences that can be scaled up if need be. Now imagine China was no longer to deliver panels. Well then, of course, we'd be in difficulties, but then within 1 to 2 years, we would have to be able to scale up. For this, we would need a critical mass that we can scale up. And perhaps one more thing for the German viewers. We have a regional funding program which has been opened, allowing for solar products to already be subsidized. So companies can already be helped via these programs. Thank you. You also said that it costs money. We have the Net Zero Industry Act, then the Sovereignty Fund was also planned, which was then downgraded. It's now become a strategic platform step with no additional money entering. Now, the Corona pandemic, of course, was a big challenge, and during the pandemic, the EU took up credit in order to tackle these challenges, but here we do not have fresh money entering the European level. If you take a look at the study of the Delors Institute, for example, there's a lot of support by the population to have an EU-wide investment program and to not only have a national investment program. How do you see this? Would you need the bazooka too at a European level to speak to your boss, Olaf
Well,
Scholz?
First of all, I think we need to see that there's still lots of money available in the funds. they haven't been totally utilized yet, and they're not being taken out from the structural fund or the recovery fund. So there are still funds available. And obviously the request will become much stronger when all those funding options are emptied. And the programs are so highly bureaucratic that many people react by saying it's too complex, it's too time consuming and too costly, so we don't even apply for it. Nobody really feels like applying for these funds for the moment. So not everything that comes from Europe is really all shiny and very good. We simply have to be very honest with ourselves. All those bureaucratic requirements, all the reporting obligations that basically help with transparency really make Europe very, very slow and very lame. So there is a need of internal reform and also, of course, a need for unanimity in the foreign policy area. Europe has to become much stronger, much more united. And what I would really want to say at this very juncture is that the rules have only ever been changed when Europe was in crisis mode. And Corona is a very good example of that. I think we've now reached a time in our history where we need to understand that the principles of our rules simply don't work any longer. That is true for the fiscal policy, it's true for the architecture to a certain extent, it's also true, of course, for defense policy, for the internal policy and for the democratic order in the European Union. So we cannot really keep going the way we are going now. We can't take 3 years to authorize certain expenses or certain programs. That was a very long winded answer to your question. I do feel that Europe should be able to take out loans jointly, but first of all, the money in the funds must be depleted. Let me add with another question, the question with lots of terminology. The debt brake was mentioned in one of the questions, and you said that we need to be very honest in our own debate. So we perhaps need to consider whether we need to spend money differently. By procurement, we need a mission orientation, we basically need impact-oriented budgets and an outcome control. What is your take on that? I do believe that if you look at the basic law, I don't think that we will be able to take any major steps within the legislative period, because we would need a constitutional majority. Some of the factions of the European Parliament, of the German Parliament, simply didn't want to talk about certain questions any longer. So I don't think we will be able to push major reform steps. But it's interesting to look at the economic policy take. The positioning is very, very different and changed within a matter of a few months. In the old days, they would say that the German fiscal policy is state of the art, and now It isn't any longer. Ever since the recession kicked in and the stagnation and also the higher demand for defense expenditure and a higher demand for a supply security and perhaps a higher supply in the medical field, this has changed. And now everybody says we need a fiscal reform which will allow for a loosening of the debt break, because we do have a problem right now. And the problem in Germany on top of that is that we will be able to manage the present crisis. All the data show us that we're moving upwards, but we do have a potential growth problem because we have a misfunctioning labor market. So we can perhaps push for some smaller dynamic steps and reform steps, but the rest of it will have to be discussed after the elections in 25. We will now take a harder cut, because we have quite a few more questions which we should have a look at, and that is the area of gas. Mechte Dilam-Hart asks, why does the federal government still want to extend the LNG terminals, for example, on the island of Rügen? The gas storages are filled up even though there is no Russian gas stored there, and LNG has no future. And Carsten asks, how can we understand the LNG offensive and in the combination with the climate objectives, why do they get an authorization to operate until 2043? Perhaps I should go back to the time before the war on Ukraine. I cannot remember that this was a huge debate in the climate debate. Germany had a relationship with Norway. 30% of the demand was covered by Norwegian gas, and then about 30% came through Belgium, and then we had Nord Stream 1 and 2. And I don't think that the ecological movement was up in arms against it. Perhaps I missed out on the critics. Germany has a gas consumption of roughly 190 billion cubic meters of gas, which has shrunk because industry didn't quite consume that much, but also the consumers really saved gas consumption. Nord Stream 1 had a capacity of 55, Nord Stream 2 the same. And we had four gas pipelines, three of them are broken, one of them was never authorized. So if we take the old situation, we had 110 billion cubic meters of gas that we lost. And with the LNG terminals, we are building up 5 billion cubic meters per LNG terminal, and we have 5 of them. Mukran will be the biggest, so 5 to 5.5 or 6. We lost 110 and we're building up 30. So I don't see an overcapacity here. If we are only dependent on the Norwegian pipeline and something happens there, and we live in a time where things can happen, then everyone will ask any minister, how can you just be so stupid? Did you not see what happened in the Baltic Sea and what Putin did? And therefore, I need to say, no, we don't need an overcapacity, but we need a fallback capacity, and it does cost us something. And I talked about the energy supply security. So if we have gas agreements constructed in a certain way, we would perhaps run into difficulties. We need the expansion of renewable energies, and it's a political decision to switch over to hydrogen. And that will probably lead to the result that in 2030, our power supply network and the industry can be run net zero. Sorry, by the mid-30s, the power supply, and in 40, then, or 45, industry, and then increasingly also heating. And then we have those areas that are hard to decarbonize, like aviation and ferrying. And that actually is the life term that we expect for those terminals, because we would then switch to green energy and then we can replace those terminals. So the operating periods match the changes that we expect to then take. Okay, but still 80% of the LNG in German terminals came from the United States, and it was fracking gas, and therefore highly damaging for the environment. This kind of energy is never climate proof. And that's also one of the critical points that are being raised, and particularly because the gas from the United States is so damaging for the climate. Even the Biden administration is considering switching. And you were talking about 2030, but what could happen? Because we do have lobbyists who would prefer to do things differently. Well, what I need to recall, of course, is that without very little warning or very little time to prepare ourselves, we have lost huge capacities. And perhaps had we invested earlier on in the development of green energy, we would have been able to replace those traditional energies earlier. And of course, we would prefer non-fracked gas, and we wouldn't want methane in the production process. Some of you may probably not remember how high the gas price was in 2022 and then onwards in 2023. And we're just exiting the phase where the high prices and inflation and in industrial degrowth is happening, and that we actually put all of that behind us is a remarkable performance. And now we need to consider which way we want to go. We were not in a position to take any to use the right of choice. In the beginning of 2023, I wasn't able to put questions about methane. I simply had to get the gas that we needed. We have done our calculations. We know how much we need, and we will also be ramping up hydrogen, and will of course be replacing the coal fired industries. In parallel, we took a number of safety measures, and the methane directive was adopted. And during the COP conference, huge efforts were taken to reduce the prevalence of these damaging gases. And the Biden administration has also become active, as you say. They're considering ways out. There are some countries which are more climate friendly in their gas production, because the CO2 part in the gas production of the United States is far higher than in other countries. So now we simply need to look at the capacities they become have to become more environmentally friendly.
We can talk a whole lot about gas. Thank you very much for these clear responses. But I would now like to move on to the next block. And one of the main questions comes from Bella. Bella says, one of the biggest obstacles I see is the resistance from the masses. I don't see any ways of communicating how to reach these people. My question is, are there any communication concepts for taking these people on board? Any thoughts on this? And Bijan asks something similar. He asks, why do you communicate like the governments during the corona pandemic? And with you, he means the current government, including the Greens. I do not understand the last question. Corona was an existential crisis. We had the lockdown. We had to do everything we could. The question is actually longer. He is asking, why do we not have this sense of urgency today that we had during the pandemic? Well, firstly, for the minutes, communication cannot go beyond the reality. And in phases of high inflation, where people are actually getting poorer because of the structural consequences of prices, well, people are worried in these times. And I think we need to remind ourselves that during this phase, there was an urgent need to act. Now we can say that wages are increasing again faster than inflation, so the available income is once again on the rise. According to economic estimates, this is going to lead to more demand, to more consumption, and hence also to higher satisfaction with life, aside from the political turbulences that we have to overcome. But if at the end of the month you have no money left and it's your child's birthday and you cannot fulfill her or his wishes, and I'm not speaking about the third expensive car, if you cannot afford a Playmobil toy, or if you cannot take your child to the cinema in the evening, if simply you can't do that because you do not have the 10 euros left for that, or if you do not have the 50 euros left to take along the four friends, well, then this has an effect on people. And this is a phase we had, and we haven't quite left it behind us. So the satisfaction often has material reasons. You could have the best press communication, you simply cannot communicate past reality. Indeed, we have a fundamental question here, and on the one hand, you could say we'll only raise awareness by spreading negative news. That's a success story of every negative tweet on Twitter, similarly to TikTok, where the message needs to be explosive. If you report about Europe Calling and you're on X or Twitter, where you say, okay, this was an interesting hour, and we learned a whole lot, and then there was the question about inflation, well, I'll have to do more reading. Good evening. Well, you could let it be. No one's going to like it or react to it. But if you say, well, what was wrong with this moderator? what did this man say? And then you add a few negative words, it's going to work. Not well, but somebody is going to react. And of course, we know this in our political daily life. So do we say the world is going down, everything is terrible, if we do not act, we'll all die because of the global warming? Is that the type of communication we want to spread? You can do, but I advise against it. Why? Well, because this is going to be successful in the short term, but in the long term, you'll be in competition with the next horror news. And I also do not want to be part of a political movement or class that is only successful via spreading fear. What is much more tangible is to be proud of what has been achieved and to instill hope and optimism that things can be achieved. And that's my background. When I communicate, I want to show that if we work together, we can be successful. If we take that step and it wasn't perfect, we can take the next step and take a look at what we've achieved. Energy security, done. Energy prices, going down. CO2 emissions, going down. Nuclear phase out. Is the energy supply insecure? No. These are all things that we've achieved. And now, of course, we need to tackle the transport sector. We need to ensure that we avoid the methane slip. That's all true. We need to speed things up. But, guys, we can do this. You've seen what we have done already, and now we'll take the next steps. That's my type of communicating. Of course, you can do it differently. These are two entirely different strategies of communicating. But I am convinced that I want to communicate in a way where I spread strength and optimism instead of saying that everything is catastrophic. James refers to this and he connects this to an area where it didn't work out quite that well. And that is, of course, the key word heating. 2023, as many gas and oil heatings as never before have been sold. And the sales of heat pumps has also gone up, but still too low for the targets that we aim to achieve. Now, James and many others have the question, what can be done to ensure that 3/4 of the installed heaters aren't fossil. But for new buildings, as of the beginning of the year, we have the Buildings Energy Act. Of course, in our discussion, we are concentrating on heating, but this law, this act foresees that for new builds, climate neutrality needs to be guaranteed. That means 65% renewable energies because heat pumps are, of course, powered by electricity, and the electricity part is, or the electricity is fired by 50% of renewables. So with the lever we have here, of course, the heat pump is climate neutral, but we're not at 100 yet because we do not have 100% climate neutrality. So here too, we see an increase of heat pumps and district heating, and municipalities are undertaking great efforts to decarbonize. And we, of course, support this. It is true that in specific regions, gas and oil heating can be installed. That is the compromise we reached back then. But there are more and more reports. But take a look at how the CO2 price is going to develop, how the gas price is going to develop, and what can be done with the heat pump and with the funding available, which is quite big in Germany for the heat pumps. It is actually cheaper if you integrate a climate neutral device. That was what was possible, it needs to be said. For the first draft of the Energy or the Buildings Energy Act, we did not have the majority, but with the reformed act, we are on track to achieve our goals until 2030. And that is why it is important to me, and this is the case for many things, during this legislative period, we didn't only adopt the Green Deal with its almost 20 files. In my house, in my area too, we passed one act after the next, one regulation after the next. So we changed a whole lot. And now it's all about staying with it and staying on track, so to speak. And if I may speak as a member of the party and not as a minister, if the union now announces to undo everything, then it is going to do what they did for 16 years under Merkel, to have no plan, back and forth, terrible expansion of renewable infrastructure, neglected everything, such as smart meters. One was almost proud of this. And now they're announcing that once again. We don't have to do a whole lot of new things. We have to ensure that we stay on track. The expansion of the renewable energies is up and running. Solar and wind power is working out very well. In the tender of the first quarter of this year, we subsidized 2.5 gigawatts of wind. We have to get to 10, but the tendency is going up. Now it's all about staying on track to actually implement the laws that have been passed, instead of undoing everything again. If you now promise we're going to do it better by doing it differently, well, by doing that, you're actually saying that we're going to throw everything away and that's going to push us back for years. Also, economically speaking, because we have companies that are relying on these laws, also in their production. So from a climate viewpoint, but also from an economic viewpoint, this doesn't make sense. Also in light of the view that we've been doing this, we did this already for 16 years. And wrong was the polite word. Now, wind power, you alluded to it. Of course, that's very important, but you need to take a look at the different states. And Nordrhein-Westphalia is being celebrated because the black-green government has achieved a whole lot when it comes to expanding wind power, but there are other countries such as Bavaria or Baden-Württemberg or Saxony or Thuringia where one is really far behind. And it would be much faster if we got their help. As the Minister for Economic Affairs, how do you talk to them? How can you get them to be on board and to stick to the goals? The expansion of wind power, which certainly is the most difficult and controversial area when it comes to expanding renewable energies. But we're seeing great tendencies here. We need to get to 10 gigawatts. Last year, we authorized 2.5 in this first quarter, so it is getting more and more. But it is true that the expansion, especially taking place in the northeast and the northwest, and the states you mentioned are behind. There are reasons for this. It is also not because of the biodiversity. Of course, there might be a few population clusters that make it a bit more difficult, but I come from a state when I did my A-levels in 89, there was zero wind turbines. Today, we have a whole lot more, and the biodiversity is also becoming better and better. So it is possible. You can bring together an expansion of wind power and biodiversity. But for this, you need good leadership. Authorities need to be told that this is now desired. And when they ask, should we really have accelerated authorization processes? And you need to say yes. And this is the task of the minister presidents. But without clarity and political will, this is not going to happen. From Baden-Württemberg, I know that Kretschmann is really doing his utmost. And we also see successes in Bavaria now where things are starting. They're not quite there where they would need to be. 2.5 years, Markus Söder said we have no wind in Bavaria. Wind power doesn't fit with Bavaria. And until today, he proudly says, we are the world champions of solar energy. But unfortunately, the sun doesn't shine at night. That also goes for Bavaria. So this is a problem. And the industry is, of course, aware of this problem. We have the association of German companies, which is very close to the CSU. And of course, now it is being said, okay, we will stick to the rule, but we'll allow for exceptions because Bavaria is noticing that the investments are going wherever electricity is cheap and renewable. Now, there's a company that looked all over Europe to see where they could build up their factory. They could have gone to Portugal or to Poland, but instead they went to the west coast of Schleswig-Holstein because green electricity is available in masses there, and that is going to repeat itself. Companies are asking governments, where are our wind turbines that we can build up to lower our electricity costs? And wherever this is not going to happen, there is going to be economic pressure. The regional governments know this, which is why I'm sure that also in the states mentioned hitherto, this is going to get going. And if not, these states, well, how can I put it? The political will of the majority is going to go the other way.
Thank you very much. A very brief reply, please, to the solar package, because many asked about the balcony solar systems, 400 megawatt. I can't quite remember, but that, I think, is a great success story of last year. And when will this become easier? Yeah, the solar package is perhaps a term that is well known, but everybody asks themselves, what's inside? A lot of elimination of red tape. You won't have to apply for any authorizations. You can install bigger solar panel installations. There's also a planning module for wind power installations, and we make it more attractive for everyone, and it will work for everyone immediately. It has been finalized in the negotiations, and we have agreed in the coalition government that it is an agreed package. And I really do hope that since everybody is waiting for it, it will come very soon. It is an act which should work to actually speed up the processes, and therefore we are also called upon to speed up the process of really enacting it, because people want to have a cheaper power supply. They want to charge their car batteries with their own energy supply that they produce themselves. We wanted a variation of fees in the system, and that is also guaranteed. You can actually steer your own consumption via the pricing modules. So we need this huge differentiation, and it must come very quickly. And what has also been expected for a long time is the climate allowance, which is a sort of a kickback. We talked about it about a year and a half ago. It is something that has been raised in English English and in German, it is not only socially just, but it would also improve the acceptance. And Ingrid Busch-Merz also connects this topic with the topic of the far right and the extreme right populism, and says that if people with a very low income actually feel that they get a credit for climate expenses, that would help. Obviously, it is closely connected with a coupling of the account numbers and the payout terms. It would probably come towards the end of 2024 or at the beginning of 25. The technical preparations would then be finalized, but there is no method yet to actually make it income proof. So the easiest form of a climate allowance would be possible, but I think we should have a debate on whether it should be the simplest form of a climate allowance or whether we should actually make it income proof. Should there be a differentiation between those living in rural areas and in the metropolitan areas, as they do in other countries? Because we do have two different sums. We know that the need to take your car in a city is much reduced as compared to living in the rural area, where you need to cover a distance to work, perhaps of 20, 30 kilometers, and take your children to school by car. So I think that the modalities of the climate allowance should still be revised and negotiated. Will the super rich be entitled to the same climate allowance as people who really earn the bare minimum income? We had reduced the CO2 prices and had started working on the climate allowance, but this will probably be linked. We would perhaps have a competing situation between two different allowances. We said at the beginning of the legislative period that we would take over the EEG funding. And on top of that, we would perhaps not pay the climate allowance. The EEG kickback will be rather high this year. It's not a huge problem for the future. So there is a commitment to redistribute for renewable energies, and if we paid it out, it would be about €200 per person climate allowance. But we already pay out a lot of money to the citizens. Well, of course, it's all a question of feeling the impact of that. And the Austrians reported in one of our webinars that they chose the simple way forward, and then they qualified it further. But the FPÖ was pushed back tremendously in Austria. That was perhaps also considered. If you have a higher income, then you have a tendency of consuming more energy. So a higher income family will also have a higher CO2 production, and they will probably benefit from it tremendously. But I think that we need to find answers to all these questions of social justice. And in Austria, as you said, they also took up that debate. Then during the last 4 minutes that we have, I would like to mention one more observation on social justice. If money becomes so scarce towards the end of the month that you can't pay for going to the cinema any longer, then you'll probably have to consider new ways of offering a climate allowance to the lowest income groups in our societies, and perhaps you could give us a short reply on that. The GEG subsidy, I'm not sure whether I'm really fully knowledgeable of all. There's also the premium that was paid out when you divested yourself of an old car. And in the GEG subsidy, the idea is that you are paid out a lump sum, and then you receive an extra bonus for those who actually implement new energy saving technology in a building by a shorter period of time. The economists normally tell us that any such support and any such equalizing method would normally be achieved by the taxation system. So you could pay out a subsidy in a lump sum, and then would have to declare it in your tax return. And that would be an equalizing method. And that would also perhaps be a way forward for the climate allowance. And those who earn a lot of money would probably not be allowed to keep the total of the climate allowance. It could be discussed, certainly. You will just have to discuss the modalities, and I'm sure that everyone in the room has their own opinion on that. Well, the question is also whether the transition must automatically be socially just. Any such transition is not automatically socially just, I would argue. But there's a lot of transition also facing us because of the war on Ukraine. We don't have enough funds to cover for childcare and for helping the poor, and we need to support Ukraine, but we mustn't forget that we still have 20% children living in poverty in our society. Yes, as a Minister for Economic Affairs, we talked about a number of areas, but we also know that the households with a low income consume the totality of their income. So if you offer them more money, they will spend it. And that's certainly not my main argument for offering a basic security for children. It is socially just. If we have a differentiated system of child allowances, for the moment, we have a situation where the richest households get just as much child allowances as the lowest income groups. And some who are in the lowest brackets of incomes don't even get the child allowance. That children of wealthier families profit much more is simply an inequality in the system. And there is a second inequality, which is even more alarming. There are people who are entitled to extra allowances. They get all sorts of supports and they hardly use them. They're entitled to these benefits, but even the offers that we make to equalize any inequality in income are not being utilized. And I don't need to be a minister for economic affairs to say, well, this shouldn't be possible. Every child should be treated the same way. Every child has the same value in our country and our society, and they should all be able to utilize the benefits that they're entitled to. It's essential that we stick to that equality policy and the social justice policy. We talked about the climate allowance just before we started talking about this, and there must be a payment method available which would automate the whole process. It shouldn't be ever so difficult to count the number of your children and to declare your income. And then you would say families X, Y, and Z are entitled to receiving X amount of money and you transfer it to them. Perhaps people opt not to make their income available and not be transparent about it. Okay, that's a different story. But if the state, as it were, the authorities say that that we are a service provider to the population, then we should find the way to make it available. And we should help the poorest. Here's your money, and we pay it out to you. It should be a very basic and simple method in order to achieve that sort of justice for children. And I hope we will manage to achieve that, although it looks difficult.
Yeah, Robert Habeck, thank you very, very much for taking the time. I'd also like to thank the interpreters, as well as the many who asked questions. And I'd also like to thank the sponsors that make Europe Calling possible. I'll put the link into the chat if you want to support us. Thank you very much indeed. A good evening to you, Robert Habeck. The very best, and see you next time. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure, and see you next time.